Our stories here at Haunted History often revolve around the misdeeds of cruel people, societal ills, and unexplained phenomena. But what about the natural world? Nature, in all its splendor and power, knows not of right from wrong. On January 12, 1888, the sun broke out after a long and intense winter that plagued the American Midwest. Arriving early and fiercely, the winter had borne over 3 feet of snow over a period of just a couple of months. Farmers kept their families huddled inside, waiting for the weather to break before tending to their outdoor projects, animals, and overall livelihoods. When the sun kissed young Ida Westfallen's face on that fateful morning, she was gleeful. The melting snow and warm air beckoned all outside. The tides had turned, finally, on one of the most brutal winters that the upper Midwest had ever seen. As such, Ida and her peers trotted off to their country schoolhouses on that morning, invigorated and underclothed, as the warm spring air had manufactured hope and promise. Little did they know, a great calamity was brewing in the north, gearing itself up to wreak havoc on the unsuspecting communities of the Great Plains and beyond. Today, I'm telling you the story of the Schoolhouse Blizzard, or the day the blizzard was king. Hello, 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 and welcome back to Haunted History. I'm your host, Megan, and every week I'll be taking you on a little journey through our world's haunted history. I hope everyone is having a wonderful week, as always. Is it snowing where you are? I know we have quite a few listeners in warmer climates, but being Canadian, I just cannot imagine a Christmas without snow. It hasn't snowed here yet on the West Coast, at least where I am. Just rain, but I am hoping it does. I usually find winter around here divides people, those who love the snow and those who cannot stand it. I happen to love the snow, so I'm saying bring it on, Mother Nature. At least for Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. I find it's always special when it flurries a little bit on those days. Nothing major. Also, just a reminder, if you haven't had a chance to check out our Patreon yet, but want a glimpse of the behind-the-scenes action, you can check it out at patreon.com/hauntedhistorypod. We have uploaded a Q&A session with Chloe where she answers some of your top questions. And of course, we have more content coming your way. And if you like Haunted History, it's just a great way to support us. And you know, it gives us the ability to keep making these episodes every week. Well, that's it for me today. I am ready to get to today's story. Today's story contains child deaths and mentions of amputation. In the 1800s, one-room schoolhouses dotted the landscape of the American Midwest. Serving many counties and communities, they would house children of all ages. In rural America, these small, isolated units, often headed by young women, served as the backbone of education in the frontier country. The structures were hastily built with tar paper roofs and gap-holed walls. They were the product of the feverish pioneer's mentality that was overtaking the area. Life for children in frontier America was brutal. When they weren't being used as labor on family farms, they would be sent to these prairie schoolhouses to receive a rudimentary public education. In order to do so, they would journey daily through unforgiving terrain. The climate was austere, and threats lied behind every corner. Everything from literal big bad wolves to roaming drifters. What's more, the weather in the American plains was categorized by extremes and could change on a dime. However, settlers in these regions had grown accustomed to the harsh realities of frontier life. They were tough folk and had learned how to adapt, for the most part. Communication in pioneer America was basic. At the time that our story unfolds, the telegraph was the quickest way to relay a message over a long distance. As such, it was challenging to foresee major weather events. Experience and patterns could dictate, at the very best, perhaps what would unfold in a 12-hour window. However, if we judge just how unreliable meteorology can appear to the layman nowadays, given our current technology, one could imagine just how unreliable these things were in the past. The winter of 1887, folding into early 1888, had been merciless, even by the standards of the area. It was actually part of a larger meteorological trend that had been unfolding in North America for 6 years at that point. Known as the Little Ice Age, this period was caused due to the eruption of the Indonesian volcano at Krakatoa in August of 1883. The thick flumes that resulted from the outburst created an atmospheric shield that effectively plunged the globe into freezing temperatures from 1882 to 1888. In North America, cold air had been descending steadily southward, reaching areas as far as Texas. By the end of November in 1887, upper Midwest states like Minnesota and Wisconsin were already blanketed with 2 feet of fleecy snow and had been rocked by snowstorms, ice storms, and everything in between. In December, the landscape was blanketed under over 3 feet of snow overall. The winter was unrelenting all the way through January, trapping entire families indoors. Outdoor tasks that would normally assure financial gain for families were put on hold. But as it was, settler families knew the drill, so to speak. When cold snaps came in, losses were inevitable. They hunkered down and waited for it to pass. On January 5th, 1888, a sleet storm barraged the upper Midwest, adding another layer, literally, to communities barely scraping by. The ice storm coated trees and buildings with a thick slab of ice. Farmers would only venture out to perform the most essential of tasks, and by January 9th and 10th, a long-awaited period of respite began showing itself. On the morning of January 12th, after a week of being held hostage by the elements, communities in the upper Midwest were greeted by a warm, unctuous sun. Droplets began to trickle down from tree branches as the ice sheet relinquished itself under the warming power of the light. Wildlife began to bustle around. The frosty hostility of the last week was abating, and life was daring to be jubilant in the face of reprieve. This proved true for the human inhabitants of these areas, too. Like their animal counterparts, local families stepped out of their farmhouses, incredulous at the shift in temperature. From below freezing, temperature soared to above 0 degrees Celsius, reaching almost 4 degrees Celsius in some areas. Not knowing when the reprieve would end, farmers busied themselves with tending to their animals, chopping wood for their wood-burning fireplaces, or even traveling over to the other towns to get supplies. Some tended to their animals in shirt sleeves, with a smile on their face. The world, it seemed, was awakening from house arrest. Children, for their part, were sent off to school. The numerous days of consecutive bad weather had forced many of them to miss out on their teachings. As such, they scampered off into the countryside, trudging through the brush, fields, and woodlands, all headed towards the schoolhouses that peppered the landscape of their rural ranges. As they walked from their homes and hearths to school, the melting snow proved a gleeful distraction. Perfect for snowball making, the warming snow heralded the promise of spring. The overall sentiment of euphoria caused children to walk to school without bringing gloves or adequate coats, as the balmy weather favored less layers. The U.S. Army Signal Corps, based in South Dakota, had just moved from Deadwood to Rapid City. The Signal Corps was the precursor to the National Weather Service, which wouldn't be formed until 1890. Having just completed the move, they began tracking and relaying weather patterns on January 1, 1888. On the morning of January 12th, the Signal Corps office noted that a storm of considerable energy had moved southward from Canada and was headed towards Colorado. This information warranted what was called a cold wave warning. However, it was never relayed to the folks in the communities that make up the modern-day Dakotas, Nebraska, Minnesota, Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho. By mid-afternoon, the balmy promise heralded by the morning had begun to fade, and the weather was beginning to turn. Little did the communities of upper Midwesterners know, the warm weather was but a momentary sputter breathed upwards from the Gulf of Mexico. A massive Arctic cold front, 800 miles wide, was bearing down upon them. A cavalcade of snow, ice, and wind, the so-called Blizzard King, was coming. Around noon that day, winds were clocked in at around 40 miles per hour. Less than an hour later, these speeds are said to have doubled, and the land was barraged with gusts reaching 80 miles per hour. By 2 p.m., temperatures began to dip incredibly fast, and pure white snow began to descend upon the land in a fury. Temperatures in North Dakota were recorded as having dropped to minus 25 degrees Celsius in just a matter of hours. The worst overall temperature drop was recorded in Fort Buford, the westernmost part of the state. There, temperatures plummeted from below zero to minus 30 degrees Celsius in mere hours. Climatologist Mark Seeley, in a PBS documentary short covering this event, states that there were some places that experienced an 18 degree temperature drop in minutes. What's more, the furious flurries devolved into whiteout conditions pretty quickly. It was said that folks could not see from the barn to the house. Some areas experienced snow, whereas others experienced ice pellets falling in almost diagonal sheets. One man who survived the ordeal recounted how the ice pellets caused his eyes to become frozen shut. As such, community members scurried off to the closest shelters, barns, haystacks, and lean-tos, anything for relief against the battering elements. One man who had traveled to grab supplies while his pregnant wife was experiencing contractions survived only by hiding out in a pig stall for 3 days. Another survivor, a man named Frank Thompson from Spearfish, South Dakota, would journal about the harrowing advent of the snow.
It began on a warm morning, about 10 o'clock or sooner, and ended at 4 o'clock the next morning. Storm slid under the warm air. Snow like flour. You could not breathe in it. I was 7 years old and stuck my head around the corner of the house and nearly choked before I got indoors again. Snowbanks like sand. Horses made no tracks. Snow drifts 30 feet wide. Then bare ground for 30 feet. Then another drift. The next day was clear and cold.
As for the children of the communities, two factors conspired against them that day. The speed at which the weather turned, and the horrible timing of the event. In the hour following the weather turn, school ended, and school teachers and their pupils were faced with a choice. Brave the storm in an effort to return home, or stay put and weather the elements from the inside of the schoolhouses. The decision, however, often befell upon the school teachers, many of whom were mere teenagers. For the most part, it was decided that the soundest choice was to remain in place. Survivor Carl Salty from Minnesota recounted the sheer speed that the storm rolled in.
A dark and heavy wall built up around the northwest, coming fast, coming like those heavy thunderstorms, like a shot. In a few moments, we had the severest snowstorm I ever saw in my life, with a terrible hard wind, like a hurricane. Snow so thick, we could not see more than 3 steps from the door at times.
Lois Royce, a teacher in Plainview, Nebraska, decided to escort 3 of her young pupils aged 6 to 9 from their chilled schoolhouse to a boarding house on a nearby farm, just 75 meters away. The short distance, she reasoned, was worth the trek. However, they had barely made it out of the schoolhouse when they became engulfed by raging winds, furious flurries, and bitter, all-encompassing cold. They quickly became disoriented. The little group struggled in the whiteout for hours, sometimes missing the outbuildings by mere feet. Meanwhile, another young Nebraskan schoolteacher named Minnie Freeman was pondering the same choice that Lois had. Stay and weather the storm in a classroom where the only heat source was a wood stove with a rapidly dwindling fuel source, or step outside into the clutches of the merciless storm, the likes of which she had never seen. Outside, the winds roared like freight trains. From the small window of the creaking wood building that served as a schoolhouse, all she saw was an endless plain of white. Then, in a thunderous swoop, the winds of the snowstorm tore off the roof of the schoolhouse. Minnie rallied her young pupils. She used a piece of rope and tied all 17 of them together, single file, with herself at the helm. Together, they stepped out into the hostile wasteland. She corralled them incessantly, motivating them to keep moving as gale force winds bombarded them. She carried the smallest, a girl, in her arms. The work was incessant, and she was forced to cheer and motivate the children to keep them advancing, even as her own strength and spirits were beginning to dwindle. As the snow overcame her, she frantically took in the situation. Drowning in a sea of white, her pupils oscillated between hopelessness and fear. Minnie furrowed her brow and pressed on. For Lois, the blizzard had proved overwhelming. Ultimately, she and her three students were unable to reach safety in time. By morning, all three of the children had perished. Lois, for her part, was able to find help by crawling to another nearby farmhouse. Luckily, she survived, but she suffered from severe frostbite and needed to have both of her legs amputated from the knee down. As for Minnie, by some stroke of luck, after some time, a house had materialized before her. She and her group had reached safety. Minnie Freeman had successfully coaxed and ushered 17 of her pupils to the safety of her own home, a mere mile and a half away. Minnie's ordeal saw her branded as a folk hero for some time. She was named as the Fearless Maid of Nebraska for her quick thinking and heroism. The young woman who was from Mira Valley in Valley County even had a song written about her, titled Nebraska's Fearless Maid. Her story, however, was exceptional. All in all, it's believed that the blizzard, which lasted 12 to 18 hours and would eventually be dubbed the schoolhouse blizzard or the children's blizzard, claimed the lives of around 235 people. Half of those were children who were caught coming home from school. Because of their smaller bodies and circulation system, the cold quickly consumed them. Hypothermia was the cause of death for those who could not escape the elements. Because of the lack of reliable data, it's believed that the number of people who perished due to the blizzard is situated somewhere between 200 and 500. The blizzard was not solely responsible for claiming lives. Many people died from pneumonia, resulting in being confined in close quarters during the particularly frigid winter months. What's more, a slew of folks needed to have their body parts amputated due to frostbite. Infections were rampant and decimated another significant chunk of the population. In his book chronicling the event titled The Children's Blizzard, author David Laskin states that, much like how Pearl Harbor scarred a generation of Americans, the schoolhouse blizzard greatly affected a generation of Great Plains settlers. It's reported that many left the area in droves following the event, having been deeply affected by the trauma of finding the bodies of their loved ones frozen in time, often in states of horror or despair. In the months and years that followed the harrowing ordeal, support groups were organized for survivors to discuss their experiences and share the emotional load. Although it was not a concept that was fleshed out at the time, no doubt many of the folks that survived the schoolhouse blizzard suffered complex post-traumatic stress disorder from the sheer amount of lifelessness left behind in the snow. Luckily, their groups, like the organization known as the Blizzard Club, offered solace and companionship. There, they swapped stories and tried to heal. Stories like that of beloved young farmer Eric Olson from Minnesota. When the warm spell descended upon the region, Eric was beckoned out for a walk. His friends found his body days later by spotting 2 feet jutting out from under a snow pile. His body was frozen and blue, as though a curse had been bestowed upon him. One of the more gutting tales was that of young sisters, Ida and Matilda Westfallen, aged 13 and 8, respectively. Ida was the young girl that we mentioned at the beginning of this story. The sisters were on their way home from school when they got caught in the winter storm. Their route should have been straightforward, but as was the case with many, they got disoriented by the enveloping snow. Their bodies were found frozen the next day by their parents. It had been apparent that they had ran around in circles before finally crumbling from exhaustion. In one final act of bravery, older sister Ida had removed her coat and placed it over her younger sister. The schoolhouse blizzard marks another case of Mother Nature reminding us that she is the one who calls the shots. Newspaper headlines of the day communicated the sentiment. Conquering Boreas, Midnight at Noon, and Blizzard King were some of the titles that circulated around that time. They were all reminders that the fierce winter storm, born out of nowhere, it seemed, had humbled American settlers in the Mid and Northwest. Indeed, survivors recalled that the Great Plains had become an ocean of white, the cresting waves being the tops of the gargantuan snowdrifts, and beneath the blanketing waves of snow lay homes, buildings, and bodies, a testament to how quickly a human settlement could be wiped out. Settlers of the Great Plains region, North and South Dakota specifically, were hardy folk. They endured brutal conditions, and their way of life was no stranger to strife. But for all their daily toils, and the thick skins that they had developed through generations of working the land, a storm of that speed and power left many lifeless in the great white expanse. It also ensured that a generation would remain scarred, constantly remembering the implications of being caught away from the hearth. One can imagine that among the dead were children ambling to find their way home, and their parents wandering about trying to unite with them. Well, friends, that's it for me today. If you've enjoyed our time spent together, please take a minute, leave a review, or give us a rating, and check out our Patreon if you want to get in on all the behind-the-scenes action. Have a wonderful week, and I'll see you next Tuesday.